Good evening!
Good evening!
I trust you're all ready for your audit. 5 years' worth of financial records and a complete set of receipts for everything you wish to claim. Here at Liars League, where writers write, actors read, audience listens, and everybody pays, we take such matters very seriously. Some of you are almost certain to be found owing money. Some of you may owe much, much more. Welcome to Death and Taxes. Now, my advice for those who die, declare the pennies on your eyes, because I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. We have 6 case studies to help you complete your returns. 3 in the first half, before we offset the interval against previous year's earnings and amortize the infamous Liars League book quiz. Woo! Then 3 more cautionary tales. One thing is certainly certain. The unwelcome ringing of a phone mid-performance will tax our actors way past their fragile limits. Please silence your mobiles. And so, on to our first story, which will be number 35 by Joshua Osso, be read by Lynn Sigoski. Joshua was born in Birmingham. His work has appeared in Prol, the Canary Press, Birkensnake, and Glassfire magazines. He loves paella and patina. He dislikes injustice and slippers. Lynn's recent roles include Clary in Steel Magnolias at Islington's Hope Theatre to multiple 5-star reviews. Apart from voice work in various media, she helps non-actors become better communicators, playing impossible people from doormat drudges to kick-ass alpha females in places ranging from Mexico City to Milton Keynes. Lynn!
Number 35 by Joshua Osto. I've lived on Lumsdale Road my whole life. My brother lives across the street and 3 doors down in the house that we both grew up in. When I married Harry, I made sure we moved onto Lumsdale Road. It wouldn't feel right to live anywhere else. And birds of a feather need to stick together, they say. But there's been so much trouble these last years to do with number 37. Then Harry let me down, Christmas just gone, after the party at Devon's, sucking on that young girl's ear like some kind of pervert. He was drunk though, and thought it was all a laugh. I thought it was all over. A year before that, they arrested Cresswell. They found all sorts in the basement, stuff that you wouldn't want to think of. Not just bodies, but bits of bodies. Some people said that they weren't surprised that Cresswell had one of those faces. Not like my Harry, who has the face of a naughty cherub. It's because I've led a blameless life, he says to me. He's a cheeky one. Cresswell kept to himself, pretty much. No friends. After they took him away, number 37 was empty for a long while. None of us on the street knew what to feel about it, really, because we didn't like the house standing empty. But then we weren't sure that we wanted someone to move into it either. It's creepy, Harry said. It gets into people's thinking. We don't want it empty too long, Tess. We want things to get back to how they were. My brother, Wilfred agreed. It's a reminder, Wilf said. We need a nice young couple to move in there. We didn't get a nice young couple, though. That man with the ratty face moved in.
I wonder if he's one of those murder fans.
Harry mused. I told him to drink his tea and stop worrying about it. The house had someone in it now, and that was a good thing. We live at number 35, you see, which is right next door to number 37. The ratty-faced man came round after a couple of days. He brought us some wine as a gift. But Harry and I stay away from drink mostly, so we said to him that was very nice, but we'd rather have some tea and digestives. We invited him in. My name's Tony, he said. Harry was just staring at him funny, so I told Tony what our names were. I gave him a look over while he ate our digestives. His fingernails looked like they could do with some attention. Underneath, each nail was dark with dirt. I almost slapped the biscuit out of his ends and told him to go and wash them. His t-shirt had paint marks on it. You're a decorator by trade, then? I asked him. He shook his head. No. I work at the yard, he said. I drive a forklift. You've got paint on your clothes, I told him. Just sorting out the house, he said. You know how it is. We knew how it was. Everyone knew how it was. He didn't stay long, and we were glad when he left. Agatha and Chrissy were round 10 minutes later. What's he like? Agatha asked. Is he simple? Chrissy asked. I heard he's simple. Cresswell was simple. Duncan Cresswell, before he was arrested and all of the body parts were found in his house, used to sit on the swing in his unmown back garden and sing to himself. He used to buy his food at the corner store, same every time. Beef and tomato pot noodle, 2 cans of tennis super, a packet of hobnobs. It was a wonder he hadn't died of scurvy. He's not simple, I said. Chrissy looked disappointed. He looks like a rat, though, doesn't he? She said a few minutes later, her face brightening. Yes, he does, I agreed. He could use a shave. You don't surprise me, Agatha said. No self-respecting man would move into that house. You mark my words, he'll be trouble. Harry sat in the corner while we talked.
Those two are idiots, he said, after Agatha and Christy had gone. I don't know why you give them the time.
Well, thank the Lord Almighty for idiots, I said, feeling cross with him, and stood up. I'm going to make some dinner.
Oh, sausages,
he asked hopefully. But I was still angry. No, I told him. We're having chips and nuggets. He made a face. Went back to his paper. Tony's name was Anthony Bouvier. The postman gave us a parcel to give to him, so we saw his name. You can't steam them like you used to, but whatever was inside didn't weigh much. Anyway, having a French surname didn't help Tony's popularity any. Right-minded people don't have much time for France. And Chrissy had once had her heart broken by a French exchange student back in her school days.
Serves her right, Harry said, cozying up with a frog muncher.
I just let those sort of comments slide off me back then. That was before he had too much to drink at Devon's party and started sucking on that girl's ear. He shouldn't have got drunk, is what I say. But Wilf has taken care of it, and there'll be none of that from now on. Wilf doesn't like Bobba. I don't know why you married that loony, Wilf said to me only last week.
Well, you introduced us, I reminded him.
Wilf got one of his black looks, and I could see his hands trembling. But there was nothing he could say, and he knew it.
Anyway,
I was talking about Tony Bouvier. Well, whatever decorating he was doing was a mystery to the rest of us. He stripped the walls all right, but he didn't start painting them again for over a month. After 2 months, one wall in the living room was brilliant white, and the rest were just grey plaster with old pieces of wallpaper sticking to them. You could see bottles and cans lying around on the carpet in the living room as well. The same carpet from when Cresswell lived there. We went around the back to look in the kitchen, and there were dirty plates piled up in the sink like a leaning tower of pizzas. He hasn't even changed the locks, Harry noticed. I didn't like that, I can tell you. Isn't that right, Agatha said. Isn't that a Cresswell? You mark my words. What kind of man moves into a house like that? Chrissy didn't agree. He's not like Cresswell. Cresswell was simple. I used to run into Cresswell in the street. He had large, wet eyes, like a cow's eyes. Sometimes he would have forgotten to tie his shoelaces. Sometimes I wonder how he did it, Agatha said. If brains was money, he couldn't buy a box of matches. But he confessed, Chrissy said, saving me the trouble. Every year, Dev and Elliot would throw a Christmas party. We all liked to be invited. Once he had one of those actresses from Coronation Street there. Caused quite a bit of excitement, even if she didn't stay much more than an hour. I think her husband killed her in the end.
On the television, I mean.
Devon's wife's called Mary. Although she's a good 15 years younger than him, which puts her about 40, I would guess, she's a quiet little thing. Her niece was visiting when the Christmas party came round, and that young miss couldn't be more different to her aunt. She was a pretty one, but tarty. She didn't seem to want to talk to the other women as much as the men.
Look how red her mouth is,
Harry said, plucking a glass of wine off the sideboard.
Should you be drinking?
I asked him, but he didn't seem to hear me.
Look at her clothes, he said. What a little slut.
He finished his wine and reached for another one. I looked around for Wilf, but he hadn't arrived yet. It was up to me.
I don't think you should be drinking, I said to Harry. I think you should give me that glass.
He looked at me with dead eyes, and I could sense him go very still. I went off then, seething and concerned, to talk to Agatha and Chrissy. Tony had arrived and was talking to Willie Pierce. He seemed shifty, moving from foot to foot. But after a few minutes, he laughed and patted Willie on the shoulder. That wasn't like Cresswell. When you spoke to Cresswell, he looked at you sheepishly, with worried eyes, and kept saying,
I don't know. I don't know,
he would say.
I don't know. I don't know.
I tried to keep an eye on Harry. I tried to keep an eye on Mary's niece as well. But an hour later, I saw them standing together. And not long after that, I couldn't see either of them. Have you seen Harry? I asked Devon.
He's had a few too many, your fella. Going to get a bit of air, I wouldn't be surprised.
He winked at me as if he'd been talking in innuendos. I went out into the street. I knew where Harry would be. The lights were on in the basement of number 37. The door was round the back. I cursed Tony then for not having changed the locks. Mary's niece was already dead when I pushed the door open and stepped inside. Harry was naked, smeared in blood. He had something in his mouth that he was happily sucking away on, like a baby with a dummy. And when he saw me, he opened wide for me to see. The girl's ear dropped out onto the basement floor. said you were going to stop this nonsense. He was in a rapture, his eyes shining with innocent joy. With a bloodied forefinger, he kept poking the dead girl's face, her head rocking emptily back and forth.
I've done another one, Tess,
he said merrily.
I've done another one! In my bed!
I thought about it. I always had to be the level-headed one. First with Father and Wilf, and then with my own husband. No, I said sternly, it wasn't you. It was that dirty little man. What sort of man moves into a killer's house, Harry, eh? What sort of a man does that?
I've got a big stiffy,
Harry said, showing me. I wasn't that interested. I was working things through, like I did before. Wilf would help again, cleaning things up here. He didn't want the attention any more than I did. I'd go back to the party and get Tony drunk. I'd wait until we were alone and then whisper to Agatha and Chrissy that he'd lunged at me. Everyone would know it had happened then, and it wouldn't be long before Chrissy had persuaded herself he'd done the same to her. Or she'd seen it happen, anything she could make up that put her in the middle of the story. I'd let her take the attention. Harry and me would tell people we'd seen Tony with that girl. Wilf would help me take care of it. Come on, Harry, I said. I could see that he was calming down, and soon he'd be able to follow me. Come on, and we'll get you all cleaned up. You need to be presentable. Where'd you put your clothes?
I don't know,
he said, shaking his head and grinning up at me, just like he'd been caught stealing chocolate.
I don't know. I don't know.
Thank you, Lynn. Our second story will be Raising Taxes by Jennifer Rickard, read by Louisa Garth. Jennifer, once a Londoner now Brummy, works two jobs, writes, and occasionally sleeps. Her first novel was written, age 6, and was a tale of epic adventure starring her guinea pigs. She still writes epic adventures, but with less guinea pig. Louisa is a highly experienced actor and voiceover. Recent work includes several roles in a new Audible comedy series, Slaving Away, and the audio guide for the Rotterdam Maritime Museum. Audiobooks include A Jane Austen Daydream, and she can be heard saying Pig Museum on the Stuttgart City Open Top Bus Tour. Louisa!
Raising Taxes by Jennifer Rickard. You're 2 days dead when they come and see me. They say they have to visit that early because if they're going to perform a raising, they need to freeze the deceased as soon as possible. But it's not a coincidence that they're also visiting when the grief is still raw. It means that they're more likely to get a signature because, well, at that point, you'd agree to anything to bring the person back into your life. They didn't have to apply that tactic to me because I decided to sign as soon as you flatlined. As soon as the hospital rang me and told me about your moment of inattention and that speeding car. They turn up at my door. Two nondescript men in grey suits. And one goes through the forms with me while the other one echoes everything he says. You're aware, of course, that we can make no promises, says the first man repeatedly, and the other one echoes, no promises. Raising can affect the mind and body in all kinds of ways, and we cannot guarantee that the person you will get back is the same person who passed away. Passed away, echoes the second man. And you understand that you will need to pay us the £50,000 tax within 7 days of signing?
7 days.
Or we cannot go through with the raising and you will still be in arrears to us.
I understand, I say, and sign.
I think about it after they've gone properly for the first time. I wasn't surprised that you'd applied to be raised. You had a zest for life that I had never seen in anyone else. It was what had attracted me to you. I'd been dangerously ill as a child, and the fear of death had always haunted me as a result, but you took that oh-so-human fear and you twisted it into opportunity. You knew you could die at any time, and so you lived every second with enthusiasm, saying yes to everything, doing everything, trying everything. Of course you'd want to be raised. Of course you'd jump at that second chance. I was always going to sign because you'd wanted it. Now I just had to raise the money. I'm not rich, and neither are my parents, but well, yours are. I go without much hope to see your parents. They're grief-stricken, wearing unwashed clothes, and offer me a cup of lukewarm tea, which I sip politely in their cold living room. I've forgotten how religious they were, and different kinds of crucifixes hang on every wall. It's difficult to escape looking at one. I'd rehearsed my speech in the car, but of course, when I actually have to speak, it all comes out wrong, and when they stare at me pityingly until I stumble to a finish. Jill, your dad says, looking at some point over my shoulder instead of at my face. You know there's a reason why he listed you as next of kin and not us. Because you would never sign, I realise. Your mother, her face lined with pain, lets out a long sigh. He's with the Lord now. Why would we want to take him from heaven? Your father nods as if he agrees, but his eyes say something different. He doesn't say anything further, though. And as soon as I've choked down my tea, I leave. Your best friend, Melanie, is next on my list. You had a lot of female friends. You always said you got on better with women than with men. You and Melanie seemed to fight a lot, though, but maybe it was all banter. You never stopped texting her, even when you and I were on dates. Melanie and I meet in a cafe where I have a better cup of tea, and she chain smokes out of a window. She's almost as rich as your parents, and she's not as religious, so I'm optimistic, but that optimism is quickly shattered and she lets out a sigh just like your mother's. Jill, listen, she says. It's not that I don't want him back, it's just I put my teacup a little too forcefully back in its saucer. Just what? Melanie sounds jittery. Well, you've heard the stories. It's always on the news. The raisings that have gone wrong. People coming back lobotomised or in terrible pain or vegetables trapped in their own bodies and only able to blink and the like. Or people who are total blank slates and have to relearn everything. Or the ones whose minds change and they become criminals and psychopaths and end up killing other people. I smile, trying to keep things light. Sounds like you've been reading too many tabloids. Melanie doesn't smile back. Face it, Jill. When the government first introduced the raising, we were all overjoyed. We thought, oh, you'd never have to lose anybody again. But then they kept upping the tax. And then there were all those accidents. Now hardly
one does it, you know. She lights up another cigarette. Without being harsh, Jill, it's just not worth the money anymore. I'm sorry. She breathes out a nervous plume of smoke. It's because I loved him that I can't help. Which is bullshit, of course. I go to the bank. But they don't offer loans on raisings anymore. People were so desperate for the money that they'd say any lie and get arrested for their pains. And then there was that spate of people trying to renege on the loans when the person who was raised didn't come back quite right. I attempt to wheedle my way into a regular loan, but lying about its purpose, but apparently I'm just not a wise enough investment. So I go to the company that I work for in the hope that they might show mercy, but I'm just a low-paid worker and they have no interest in publicly funding a raising. It's not a popular cause these days. And there's barely any charities left that will help. I'm starting to run out of options. With 2 days of going through every idea I can, I eventually ring Carla, my best friend. And we've both known Carla for a long time. We used to call her the fixer because she always had the answer to everything. Plus, she doesn't judge. I lay it all out for her over a large glass of wine. I'm sick of tea. So, she says, after we've finished, you've exhausted all the options. Well, all the legal ones, anyway. I stare at her. What do you mean? Carla looks at me. A very direct look that I only really saw on your face. Tell me, Jill, what would you do to get him back? Anything. I say immediately, and I mean it. I meant it, as soon as I signed the forms. Okay, she says, so softly that I almost miss it. Let me see what I can do. I don't have much time, I remind her. I can work quickly, she says. For him. Carla isn't kidding. Halfway through the next day, she calls me and gives me an address to meet her at. It's a nondescript brick building, and she opens the door with her own key. This place belongs to a friend of ours, she says. And I realise that ours means her and you. I didn't know you had any shared friends. In the building waits a man in a suit, bland and boring, just like the men who came to visit me with the forms. He introduces himself as Terry, which I can tell is not his actual name. Terry does not waste time and cuts to the chase. Have you heard much about black market organ donation? What? I say, almost laughing, because this has to be wind up, right? But Terry doesn't look like he's joking. He inspects me with interest. We're looking for a kidney for someone with your blood type. It's quite a rare type, isn't it? All amusement suddenly drains out of the situation. How do you know that? I ask. Oh, Carla told me, Terry says, but doesn't say how Carla knew. Look, there's barely any risk these days. We can get top medical staff involved, and I can get you 50k out of it by your deadline. You're healthy, aren't you? I am, right? I mean, pretty ill while I was young, but now? Of course, I say. Great, says Terry. We'll rush all the tests tomorrow and do the operation the next day. He doesn't ask if that's okay with me. He knows a desperate woman when he sees one. I go through all the tests the next day, like someone in a dream. And I'm told they are all good enough, although I get the feeling Terry would want to go through with the operation even if they weren't. I wonder who the kidney is for, but I don't ask. There would be no point. The day after, the operation. As soon as I wake, I can tell something has gone terribly wrong. My body barely feels like my own. What happened? I ask Carla, who's by my bedside. We got the kidney out fine, Carla says. It was transplanted successfully. Here's your 50k. She dumps wads of cash next to me on the blanket. But, I say, there were complications, Carla says. You weren't as well as we thought. I knew this, of course. Deep in my heart, I knew. And I still went through with it. How long have I got? I ask. Weeks, Carla says. Weeks of agony. I focus on the money on the table. Worth it, I say. Yes, says Carla. I pay the raising tax with one day to spare. If there's anything odd about paying in bundles of used notes, the men in suits say nothing about it. You are removed from the freezer, and the raising process begins. They call us when you've been raised, and we go to the hospital to pick you up. Oddly, when it comes down to it, I can't go into the room first. So Carla goes instead. I sit in the waiting area, hand pressed to the fire in my side. The clock is ticking for me, but at least I'll be able to see your face before I go. I haven't applied for raising myself, but there's no way you'd be able to pay for it. Carla comes out after a few minutes. He's all right, she says. And there's tears in her eyes. Everything's working. He's walking and talking and everything, he said. And then this look passes across her face. Such a look that can mean only one thing. And suddenly I think about what a great friend she's been to you. She was meant to be my best friend, but the two of you were always so close, weren't you? Always very close. He said, "Hi, Carls," she tells me, and bursts out laughing, hysterical. I breathe a sigh of relief. Suddenly it's okay. I can see you. I have to see you. I stand up with effort and I push open the door. And there you are. Sat in on the hospital bed in a hospital gown, still wired up to things. You're very pale. But it's you. It's your messy blonde hair and your blue eyes. It's you. And you're alive, you're alive. And you turn your head to the door when I walk in. You blink your blue eyes and I smile, overjoyed. Hello, darling, I say. And then I watch your brow slowly furrow into a frown. Sorry, you say. Who are you?
Thank you, Louisa. Our third story and the last one before the interval will be a piece of me by Matt Kinnich. be read by Anton Thompson McCormick. Matt lives in Switzerland. He used to teach English literature and the occasional spot of creative writing at university until reality and the promise of a higher monthly salary got in the way. Since graduating from the Drama Centre London, actor-writer Anton has played Constantin in The Seagull, Malcolm in Macbeth, and the singer in Short This Song. A World War II docu-film, captured on Crete, comes out in 2018. He is excited to be making his Liars League debut. Anton!
A Piece of Me by Matt Kimmich. I am sitting in front of the television on my favourite chair. It's been an uneventful day. Now, while I'm sitting there, the doorbell rings. This in itself is unusual, because I'm not expecting anyone. I get up, walk towards the door and look through the fisheye. There's a man outside, dressed in a blue uniform, almost like a postman's uniform. He also has that typical unconcentrated postman look on his face, like he's already thinking about what he'll do once the job is done. As I said, I'm not expecting anyone, so this is a bit of a surprise. I open the door. He gives me a flat look. Mr... He glances at the pad he's holding and says my name. Yes. I'm here for your fun. I frown. I don't have the slightest clue what he's talking about, so I say, you're here for my thumb. He shrugs. Your thumb. I'm here to collect your thumb. I'm taken aback. Why would you want my right thumb, or any of my thumbs, for that matter? It's not that I want it. I'm just here to collect it. He gestures towards a digit in question, and almost ashamed, I hide it behind my back. Understandably, I'm quite confused. Do you have a warrant or something? The man smiles and nods. He's probably as confused as me at this point, but now he feels on safe ground. Of course I have one. Here it is. He produces a sheet of paper from his bag, a sheet that has official government markings on it. I read through it, and although I don't quite understand, I accept it. The man is entitled to come and collect my thumb. I gesture somewhat helplessly with my two hands now, not quite clear what the procedure is. Oh, no problem. You just hold out your right thumb. Like that, yeah. Thank you. This won't take a second. The uniformed man takes a small device from his bag, and I follow his directions. Holding the thing against my right thumb, he pushes a button, and the finger just comes off. I'm pleasantly surprised that there's only a short tingling sensation, but no pain and no blood. As I look up from my hand, I see him put my thumb in a government-based bag and put it away. Then he hands me a receipt. Thank you. That'll be all. Enjoy the rest of your evening. He gives me a curt nod, neither friendly nor unfriendly, and walks away down the hall. Still somewhat confused, I close the door on his back and look at my right hand. There's no scar or anything. It's almost as if I never had a thumb. After putting the yellow receipt on the TV table, I get myself a beer from the fridge and notice it's a bit more difficult now to open it. Finally, I manage and sit down in front of the television in my comfy chair. A few minutes later, the doorbell rings again. I get up, spilling some of the beer over my sweatshirt and I'm wiping it the same with my sleeve, I open the door. It's the uniformed man again, giving me an apologetic smile. Sorry to bother you, sir. It's just I have to collect your left arm. My left arm. I'm stunned. I'm sorry, I have the paperwork here, you know. The man shifts his weight from one leg onto the other, looking past me into my flat. Nice place. I like the print over the television. Feeling uncomfortable at him looking at my home, I move forward and obscure his view. Can I have a look at these papers? He says yes, and quickly I scan over the sheet. It looks practically the same as the previous warrant, only now it contains a claim for my left arm, 10 centimetres below the collarbone. With a sigh, I say, go ahead. With a larger version of the device he'd used on my thumb, he removes my left arm. Again, no pain, but it feels strange not having its weight there below my left shoulder. If you have any complaints, sir, you can file them at the address printed on the receipt. There, he says, pointing at the yellow sheet of paper he's just handed me. Yeah. Good evening. Not waiting for his answer, I close the door, crumpling the receipt a bit in the process. Then I walk over to my chair and sit down. I take a close look at the receipts, but they're not very helpful. Sure, they look official and correct and everything, but and the language isn't too bureaucratic compared to other documents I've read. The only thing they're not really clear about is the reason why I have to give my left arm and my right thumb. I read through the receipts, twice even, but don't get anything useful from them. I decide to write a complaint letter tomorrow, knowing that I probably will have forgotten by the time I go to bed. I have just seen a news report from a faraway country when the doorbell rings again. I push myself from my chair with some difficulty, awkwardly trying to keep my balance with only one arm. It's the man again, and he's holding out the warrant for me to read. Busy evening for you tonight, then, is it? I say. Busy evening for the two of us, I'd say, he says. I know it must be a nuisance for you, but... Oh, it's not your fault, I'm sure, I reply with less conviction than might be called for. It's like taxes. Everybody complains about them, but we all know they're probably necessary, right? I give him a smile, feeling sorry for him. He looks as if he preferred to be somewhere else, doing something else. I know the feeling. But I try not to make him feel too uncomfortable. One shouldn't shoot the messenger. Absolutely. Right leg, just below the knee this time. He's already taken out his gadget and I hold out my leg. Well, right back. That's not so bad. I should be able to keep my balance with my right arm. I give a somewhat forced laugh. You're not going to take that as well, are you? The uniformed man shakes his head. Like many people, he's one of those who lose their sense of humour when he puts on a uniform. And I would too with that kind of uniform. No, just your right leg. There we are. Thank you. Thank you, I say emphatically, but the sarcasm obviously is lost on him. I watch him put my right leg into a large government-issue bag. The scar on my shin is clearly visible, although I can't remember where I got that. The limb doesn't quite fit in the bag, and I catch a glimpse of the toes through the plastic. I shake my head, close the door, and hop back inside. Fortunately, I manage to make it to my chair before I fall over. The TV is still showing survivors from enemy attacks down in that faraway country. They're a lot worse off than me, I think, looking at the stump just below the right knee. They say that people who lose limbs still feel phantom itches, but I don't feel anything. I still don't know the reason for all of this, but the government wouldn't spend its money, the taxpayers' money, our money, if it didn't have good reasons. My friends tell me that my attitude is almost criminally naive, but still it's better than their cynical, jaded attitude. I'm startled from my thoughts when the doorbell rings. Yeah. Not again, I think. And I groan and try to get up. Just a minute, I shoot, propping myself up in my chair. With two uneven jumps, I make it to the table and finally get to the door, my knee wobbling from the unusual exertion. No surprise as I open the door. Working long hours tonight, are we? I say, and the uniformed man shrugs. What is it this time? He points, and I blush. I can't mean that. I point as well, and he nods. My fruit and nuts, for want of a better metaphor. my gear, you know. The man seems somewhat embarrassed, which I find comforting. And to his credit, he turns away as I pull down my trousers and boxer shorts. At least he won't need one of the big bags this time, I think. I almost choke on my hysterical laughter. This would be just the moment that old Mrs. Colby across the hall opens the door to see us, and I can just imagine what kind of gossip she'd spread. Okay, that's it. Really sorry about this. Yeah. I pull up my trousers, half surprised because they used to be a tight fit. Here's your receipt. Good night. I don't really notice him leaving, nor me closing the door and hopping back into my chair. There must be a reason behind this. It couldn't be a mistake, I'm sure. There must be some kind of system, something I've done wrong. Anxiously, I try to remember exactly what I was doing when he turned up for the first time. One thing comes into my mind immediately, and I quickly grab the remote. What else? I can't say. There must have been something. I'm sure there is always a reason. I let go of everything I'm holding and close my eyes. Very slowly, almost by instinct, I curl up in a ball and start to breathe more slowly. Just to make sure, I empty my thoughts, ready to be interrupted at any moment by the ring of the doorbell.
Time for the infamous Liars League book quiz. This month, we'll be tackling the death of literature. I'm sorry, that should read deaths in literature. As ever, we can't really see you, so if you think you know the answer, stick your arms in the air and shout, tax refund. It's worth a try. Would you like to practice that? One, two, three.
Tax refund!
Most gleeful.
Passionate.
Ever, I think. Katie has asked me to warn you. If you don't know the answers, please instantly forget the questions in order to avoid spoilers. Shall we introduce the books?
Absolutely. So, a classic in more ways than one, we have the New York Times bestseller, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, recently made into a possibly
film.
Not award-winning, but a film, certainly. It was alright. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains, is the quote on the back, and that gives you some idea. And Dead But Not Forgotten, a collection of undead short stories. Now, do we have any fans of True Blood?
Yes.
Or Midnight Texas? Okay. This is one for you guys. It features some of the characters from the series, a number of different stories written by various well-known authors, including Charlene Harris and Tony Elfie Kellner. And, of course, our very own Liam Hogan, who has a story in tonight, by the way. Happy Ending, Not Guaranteed, a selection of weird, fantastical, science fictional, horrible, terrifying, and award-winning stories published by Arachne Press, the jewel of our collection. If you're very lucky and very clever, you might just get your hands on this.
Right, so we have questions. You ready?
Yes.
The first question. Which of Leo Tolstoy's heroines leaps in front of a speeding train?
Yes, sir.
is correct answer.
Spoilers! Forget it immediately.
Anybody who didn't know the answer to that, just forget it.
Forget it, yeah. Never happened. Which book would you like?
I'll take Liam's, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Excellent,
excellent choice. Good taste. Yeah. Our second question. According to Douglas Adams, who spent a year dead for tax reasons?
Oh, yes, madam.
Is the correct
No, it's not. Answer? No, it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. Any Adams fans?
Tax refund.
Yes, sir.
Full prefect?
No, guys.
Tax
yes, sir.
It's correct.
Yay! I knew you'd know it.
Also, and this is true, the name of an estate agent in Essex.
There we go. Okay, all to play for.
One look to win.
Austin and zombies. How can you resist?
In which Virginia Woolf novel does Septimus
Warren... Who was that? Okay, lady at front.
Mrs. Dalloway.
Is correct.
Oh,
and how
does
he do,
though?
We
don't
he jump off a balcony and gets impaled on a spike?
He self-defenestrates, so throws himself out of a window, will, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great word, by the way.
Forget I said that for those who haven't read it.
It never happened.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, if you were unlucky enough not to win a book, there are books on sale. We have three of the Liars anthology, which are a stonkingly good bargain at only £5. And we have a slightly less stonking bargain, which is my book, which is nominally £10, but if you can gang together with some friends or even strangers, then I'll give you 3 for £20, because that makes it
£6.66.
Oh, I like it. And we are in Halloween, so there we go. Anyway, shall we continue?
Yes, absolutely.
With the stories. Thank you, Katie. Our first story of the second part is Render Unto Caesar by Tom Heaton, read by Greg Page. Tom is a writer and video game designer. His stories have appeared or are forthcoming in Ambit, the Mechanics Institute Review, Confingo, and Dreamcatcher. This is his fourth story for Liar's Leap. Age 6, Greg was cast as Chosen in his infant school nativity. Somebody put a tea towel on his head, and he became someone else. He hasn't been himself since. A critic recently compared Greg to the late Sir Alec Guinness, saying, "Sir Alec Guinness was a much better actor." Greg!
Render Unto Caesar by Tom Heaton. The address was Cobbs, Fetters Lane. But no one on Fetters Lane had heard of Cobbs. Until at last I stopped a grey-haired old dear who was being pulled along by two eager Norfolk terriers. "The Cobbs? The loggers?" she said. "The what?" "But they sell firewood," she said. "Do they now?" I thought. She sucked her lips as if thinking something over. 200 yards that way, there's a cattle grid. Park there, across the field, and find the track going up the hill at the end. The Cobbs place is on the left. But they don't take to visitors." I'm sure I looked ridiculous in my suit, stepping in wheel ruts across an overgrown meadow, but there was no one to see me. I climbed the track between the banks of nettles, until I came to an electric fence and then a plywood gate, which scraped across the black earth as I opened it. The Cobbs place was three ramshackle porter cabins raised on bricks and extended with crude plank walls. There was a rusty logging saw with a huge circular blade and piles of split wood and plastic chairs arranged in a circle and beer cans and a Doberman, snarling and snapping at me, forcing me against a crumbling wall. A stout, bustling woman in a sleeveless chiffon blouse rescued me. Her face was flat and lined, difficult to age. She held the dog by the collar and demanded to know who I was. I said I had an appointment with Sam Cobbs and showed my identification. With Sam? She looked at me with contempt. I confirmed it. She led me brusquely inside to a grubby and chaotic kitchen, with a wooden table taking up too much space, and a counter with two camping stoves side by side, and an aluminium sink full of dirty pans. She shouted into the back, "Sam, come here, no!" He was 19 or 20, but looked like a boy, with close-cropped fair hair and rounded features that were oddly aligned. It was apparent immediately that he was what we used to call simple. "I've got your note, Sam," I said, "undated from about 2 weeks ago, saying you can't pay the sum of £590 due because of the work you did at Pryor's Farm in summer 2015. He nodded, dumbly. "What I'm here to do, Sam, is arrange a repayment schedule so you can pay an amount each month, an affordable amount, that will allow you to settle the tax bill." "Pryor's Farm was cash work," the woman said. "Are you Mrs. Cobbs?" I asked. She didn't reply. "Cash earnings are still taxable, Mrs. Cobbs, but in this instance the money was paid into Sam's bank account." "What bank account?" Sam spoke up now. They made me open one or they wouldn't pay me." Someone barged in. Bald and broad, he took up half the kitchen and had the same flat features as the woman. There were other younger men huddled behind him. "Who's this? What's he doing?" he said. "Sam opened a bank account and got his wages paid in, and here's the tax man." She rolled her eyes bitterly. "Get out of here," the man said to me. "Sam's not paying any tax. He don't need to pay tax. He's exempt. He don't use services." "Everyone needs to pay tax, Mr. Cobbs. It's the law. He don't use services." "But he went to school, didn't he? He'd go to hospital if he was injured." No one replied. "He did go to school." I saw that I'd miscalculated on this point. "Does anyone here pay taxes?" "We don't need to pay taxes," said Mr. Cobbs. "We don't use services." "But you buy food, don't you? I mean, who do you think makes it?" "We don't. We got pigs. We eat pigs for food. And we rear them ourselves." "You sell logs," I said. "That's taxable income." "Who said that?" he demanded. "Listen, our family have lived on this land for 200 years. There's always been Cobbs here. All this hill is Cobbs' land. We don't need anyone outside." I'd stumbled on a bigger case of tax evasion than I'd realised. And I conceived of a plan to investigate further. "Mr. Cobbs, I'd like to see evidence that you're self-sufficient, as you claim, that you're able to support yourselves without the use of public funds. If shown such evidence, I'll be happy to leave you in peace." Mr. Cobbs nodded at me to follow him. We walked along a long forest path to an old quarry that provided an area of flat ground. Behind a mesh fence, dozens of small breed pigs grunted happily. "There must be 60 pigs here," I said. He didn't answer. "Are these for your family's consumption alone?" He glared at me. "Where do you slaughter these animals?" I asked. With gritted teeth, he led me back along the path. We passed a pickup truck that I observed was full of split logs. "This firewood appears to be prepared for sale," I said. His dark eyes flicked towards the large porter cabin. "Storage. The truck's got no wheel," he said. "A wheel can very easily be replaced," I countered. We reached an old concrete shed, completely covered in thick ivy. "Here's the slaughterhouse," he said. As I stepped inside, he reached into my pocket and removed my mobile phone and pushed me firmly forward. The door slammed. I was in darkness. A padlock clicked shut. I hammered at the door and insisted they release me and return my property. Outside, an argument raged. Many angry voices joined in, but Mrs. Cobbs predominated, and it was clear that a plan was being laid out. There had once been a window in the shed. It was imperfectly bricked up, leaving a gap covered in ivy through which a thin strand of light wormed. I put my eye to it and saw Mr. Cobbs marching Sam, one arm pinioned behind his back and struggling in vain, into the building where I had interviewed him some 20 minutes before. I resumed my bludgeoning of the door. Well, rationally, it could achieve nothing, since I was a long way from anyone who would care to help me. It was instinct and dread. Indeed, it proved a tactical error, because it forced a change that was to my detriment. The door was thrown open, and two burly youngsters held me against the far wall. I had a view of my surroundings. The building was a workshop, with a bench along one side and numerous ancient tools scattered there. One youth produced a chain and secured my left hand to a pipe that ran up the back wall. My right hand was tied to my left behind my back with thick, greasy rope. When I protested, my mouth was sealed with duct tape. They left me bound, cowering in the darkness. My next hours were spent in terrified solitude. I was able to release my right hand from the knotted rope and use it to untape my mouth, but the chain, which dug into the flesh of my left wrist and held it tight against the pipe, would not give. Outside, there was ceaseless activity. I heard arguments, shouting, a pounding and lifting of materials, some crashes of metal. The truck started and stopped and was driven around the site. I tried for an hour to reach the tools on the far side of the bench, though at my fullest stretch, I was more than a foot short of the closest. I sat and tried to consider my situation. I was confused, sweating in fear of what might happen. I conceived of plans for escape, but none could be realised. I imagined my revenge, the Cobbs all lined up in the dock while the judge sentenced them. I despaired. I sobbed to myself. It was utterly hopeless. Evening fell. I could tell from the drumming of the dimming of the bead of light through the gap in the bricks. For half an hour, there'd been silence. But now a motor started. It was accompanied by a whirring sound and a metallic scraping. It was the logging saw. And I was able to picture clearly those rusted teeth spinning in a blur. A desperate, fearful screaming began and edged closer. And I recognised the voice as belonging to Sam Cobbs. I pictured his round, misshapen face as he formed the words, begging, "No! No! Don't! Please!" Infected by hysteria, the pigs began squealing too, a shrieking chorus of panic. I heard Mrs. Cobbs say imperiously, "It's your fault, Sam, and you'll pay. And it'll see you right." Sam's screaming intensified, then abruptly stopped. The spinning metal blade tore into something soft and dense, and an object thudded to the ground. I retched and vomited on the cold concrete floor. The blade continued to spin, and its whine pitched up each time it was forced to cut through flesh. And there was no doubt that it was flesh. The sound was yielding, muffled, until it found a bone, when it briefly climbed to a piercing screech. I became dazed at the horror of it. The door opened, and Mrs. Cobbs stood before me in the twilight. She wore an apron covered entirely in dark blood and held a butcher's knife. She'd lost her former composure and seemed oblivious to me. She put the knife on the workbench and sorted through the tools until she found what it was she wanted. She left the shed and locked the door behind her, but through some carelessness or grief, she'd forgotten the knife. It was an easy matter to get it, and I tested the blade against my skin and found it keen. Outside, the machinery had stopped. I sensed that time was short. I commenced on a plan I'd previously considered, and though aspects of it were unattractive to me, I found I had no option. With the greasy rope, I made a tourniquet around the forearm that was chained to the pipe. This required some dexterity, but I achieved it and made it good and tight. And now I found I was unable to execute the remainder of my ploy. My right hand grasped the knife, but I couldn't force it to attack my left, no matter how much will I exerted. Footsteps. A key is placed in the padlock. A desperate, all-encompassing fear overwhelms me. Fear makes me do what reason cannot. And I hack at my wrist with a butcher's knife and sever it partly, and hack again before the pain can thwart me. My hand falls away, still chained to the pipe. I rush at the open door. Sam Cobbs stood alone before me. Clearing was all changed. The buildings had disappeared as if they'd been magicked away, leaving only the blackened earth where once they stood. The chairs, the rubbish, the machinery, the truck, all gone. There was only myself and Sam Cobbs in the concrete shed, and beside it, a bloody pile of flesh as high as my waist. Pigs' heads, minus snouts and ears. I dropped the knife. Sam Cobbs handed me a dirty envelope. Inside was a bunch of damp 20s and my mobile phone. "There's the money I owe," he said. "I wish you hadn't come, because now we have to move up the hill, and they killed all my darlings." He looked sorrowfully at the pile of heads. He saw my bloody stump. "Why have you done that?" he said, and turned and ran away. A door slammed, a truck drove off through the undergrowth. I was found in Fetters Lane by the grey-haired old dear who was kind enough to call for an ambulance. The police searched the entire hill, but there was no sign of the Cobbs. It was as if they vanished back into the soil they claimed to own.
Story will be Life Plan by Liam Hogan, reread by Carrie Coe. Liam is a liar of long standing. His short story, Atta, appears in Best of British Science Fiction 2016, and his dark and twisted fantasy collection, Happy Ending Not Guaranteed, is published by Arachne Press. Carrie's theatre credits include Sandra in Tick Tock at Slam, Miss Tarleton in Shaw's Misalliance, Hetty in Geld, and my family in Hula Hoops. Film includes Grace in Just Saying, and her comic character, Hilda Pimlico, came to life within Stickman Club earlier this year. Carrie!
Life Plan by Liam Hogan. It has long been a problem that has plagued actuaries, politicians, and indeed prudent individuals such as yourselves. Planning for an uncertain future. How much should you pay into your pension, not knowing how long, or indeed if, you'll ever claim it? How much should you set aside for periods of unemployment, for healthcare issues, for assisted living? Until now, this thorniest of problems has been tackled, but far from solved, by the crudest of tools, by the bluntest of instruments, statistics. Your life expectancy and other similar data are simply averaged, which means that the man who dies the morning of his retirement party is subsidizing the woman celebrating her 100th birthday, surrounded by friends and family, and with a congratulatory message from the Queen. But is this strictly fair? Shouldn't the victim of a heart attack at the age of 65 get his allotted 10 years of rest and luxury, even if it means retiring at 55? Shouldn't the sizable pension fund he has built up through decades of toil be repaid? And not after his death. For what use is it to him then, but rather throughout all his too brief life, making it more comfortable, more enjoyable, and ultimately more rewarding. Recent cost reductions in DNA analysis, coupled with a detailed lifestyle survey, can provide some improved measure of predictability. But this approach merely sorts those average life expectancies into narrower buckets and can never deal with the truly unexpected, such as stepping out in front of the number 67 bus on a hungover Wednesday morning. Yes, sir, I am looking at you. Here at Death and Taxes Incorporated, we make the uncertain certain. Let our Easy Actuary 5000 quantum bit supercomputer crunch all of the available data, and we'll provide you with a personalized life plan guaranteed accurate to with 100 decimal places, tailored just for you. Our life plan, trademark, covers the essential big life events we know you'll want to know about, from the joyous to the, alas, rather less fortunate. From weddings and births to divorces, serious illnesses, and of course, the exact date of your death. We'll even tell you the nature of your demise if you so desire, whether accidental, cancer or some other terminal illness, homicide, suicide, or for those lucky few such as you, madam, a simple matter of old age. Death and Taxes Incorporated offers financial advice on the back of your life plan. What, after all, is the point of saving for a rainy day if that rainy day never comes? A life plan can, over the span of an average life, save you many thousands in unnecessary premiums. With a life plan in your hands, paying insurance becomes a thing of the past. We'll tell you exactly when you're going to be robbed or suffer a major fire or flood. For the absent-minded, we can send out a reminder 24 hours before each significant event. Or we can sync an entire life plan with your iPhone calendar for your ease and convenience. And please, don't worry yourself about the effect of this invaluable knowledge might have on your life. Our quantum entanglement programming takes this into account.
So no, you can't prevent disasters simply by knowing they're coming. This would, of course, invalidate your life plan, which is impossible. To the old saying that the only two certain things in life are death and taxes, here at Death and Taxes Incorporated, we'd like to add a third, a life plan prediction. You can't avoid them, but you can and you should plan for them. We'll tell you when to start saving for your first home, when you should retire, and even when you should check your partner's text messages for signs of infidelity. Yes, I am talking to you too. We'll let you know when you'll be off work with a serious illness or when to factor in maternity leave. No more being caught in a dead-end job simply because you're worried about losing your benefits. There have been some ill-informed and negative comments about life plans from the church and from government advisors. The knowledge that we give you makes them uneasy, uncomfortable. They want to keep you in the dark, blindly groping into the future. They know that what Death and Taxes Incorporates offers represents a real game changer, allowing you to convert to the religion of your choice, only when it really matters. They know that a life plan puts you, the customer, very much in the driving seat. In fact, such are the advantages of a life plan that we recommend you sign up for one as early in your life as you possibly can. We even offer a family deal. Buy one for yourself and at the same time get one half price for all of your unborn children. Not sure how many children you're having? Not to worry, we'll do the maths. Now that you've heard our sales pitch, I trust you're eager to know how to proceed. It's very simple. All you need to do is call us on 0800 666 and agree to our extremely reasonable terms. We ask for nothing up front. We don't even ask you to pay in installments. We merely ask that you pay your entire debt the day your life plan expires. Our life plan calculates in advance exactly what your worth is at that point. And that is our fee, to the nearest penny. Rest assured, it won't inconvenience you in the slightest. After all, you can't take it with you. What's that, madam? Your soul? Oh, been reading the small print, have we? Well, yes, the contract does say everything you own on the day that you die, and yes, technically that would include your soul, but again, please, be at ease. If you have been following your life plan diligently, then your soul, like your finances, will, by that final day, be inconsequential. A mere trifle, hardly worth us collecting it at all. Well, thank you for your kind attention.
Before our final story of the evening, some notices. We'll be back at the Phoenix on the 14th of November for Brothers and Sisters. Do please come along to that. Submissions are closed, but you might like to try your hand at our Christmas theme, Sacred and Profane, with a deadline of November the 5th. details along with the rest of the year's themes and recordings and videos. I don't know the rest of the year's themes, that's basically it. Recordings and videos are all on the Lyre's website. I do have another submission deadline to mention, which is for Tales from the Shadow Booth. You should see some flyers hanging around. This is done by Dan Coxon, who has had his stories read out here. So if you like your stories a little bit on the dark and weird side, submit and then buy. They also have a Kickstarter going. And this Saturday, I believe, Katie?
Yes, it is.
This Saturday, certain members of the Liars League, will be performing at Poetry Brothel.
And two of our actors as well.
Two of our actors in Catharsis. How do you say that?
Catharsis.
Catharsis. In Hackney?
Yes, that's right.
In Hackney. So there we go. On to our final story of the evening, which will be The R27th by Anne Savory, to be read by Susan Woodley. Anna was born in Medway, the only bit of Kent which isn't lovely, and now lives in Brixton. She's a comedy writer and sometime a proper comedian on stage. She inherited a cursed library from Dennis Wheatley once, but almost never mentions it. Susan is a graduate of Drama Studio London. The credits include Lady Agatha Proudcock in Oswald's Return, and We Are Gods. I have no idea how to say that. Hatshepsut.
Hatshepsut.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Silas will know.
In, there you go, in Zipporah, and Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing, and Central Film School's short film The Factory. She's also played a number of roles in new writing for radio. Susan!
The R27s by Anna Savory. I recently spent an agonising weekend completing my first ever tax return. It was the sort of long, grey slog that made me wish repeatedly for death. Once you've spent 2 hours trying to locate your 10-digit unique taxpayer reference, you really do begin to question whether you're living at all anymore. Imagine then the pleasing sense of irony and less pleasing sense of dread I had when the HMRC called me in my lunch break to tell me I'd been dead all along. According to our system, said a girl who sounded only minutes from the grave herself, according to our system, you were marked legally deceased on the 28th of August last year. I cast my mind back. No, I said, think so. Was that the bank holiday? I felt fairly alive, but I glanced down at myself just in case. Everything seemed to be in order. Bear with me, she said. Could you wait a moment? I'm just going to pop you on hold. A tinny version of Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2 played down the phone at me. I don't think I can work the rest of the day, I said to the office. Feeling peaky? I think it's more serious than that. When I got back to the flat, I found my tax documents had been returned to me. They were waiting on the doormat in a polythene bag stamped deceased and void, with a leaflet about inheritance tax. Kate, I said to my flatmate when I got upstairs, am I dead? Be honest. She looked hard at me. No, she said. Is this like when you were worried you were living in a simulation? No, this is much worse. I slid the sealed documents to her across the kitchen table like a shady, undead gangster. She turned them over and laughed. So there's a glitch in the system, do you think? What do you mean, do I think? Look at you. Of course you're not. I can't can't believe we're having this conversation. I wanted to tell her it must be nice to be so certain about things. Just right off the day, she advised. Call HMRC. Someone in the vaults will get to the bottom of it. They'll mark you alive. You can send these back. She brandished the polythene envelope. And then this evening, we'll go out for drinks to celebrate the fact that you're not dead yet. But the hold music, I said, it's so unnerving. So don't let them put you on hold. You might have to get a bit shouty. That's the best way to cut through bureaucracy. Just sound very sure of yourself as soon as you speak to a human. Kate, 5 minutes ago, I wasn't even sure if I was alive. How am I meant to master that kind of... But she'd already handed me the phone. After my third hour of Sonata number 2, I decided it would be easier to cycle down to Westminster and stand in line. When they saw me, I reasoned, they couldn't possibly argue I was 6 months deceased, but I did brush a little extra blusher on just in case. Standing in line at HMRC is very much the physical equivalent of being on hold. But at least when you're on hold in your own home, you can wander around naked, or pee, or prepare food with one hand. All of which are frowned upon in governmental buildings. Instead, I joined a long, human crocodile of boredom that shuffled forward at intervals. An hour later, I got to the desk at the front of the queue. I explained to the woman behind it, that in spite of what I had just been through, I wasn't dead yet, and I wanted it to be officially recognised. She frowned at me, so I held up my void and deceased tax bundle and gestured expansively down at my still-living self. She nodded and pointed me mutely to a side room just off the queuing atrium. There was a brass plaque on the door that read R27. I pushed it open. It was a waiting room, white. There was a low buzz from the fluorescent tube lighting, and around the edge of the room, as if spun out by centrifugal force, was maybe 20 people in black chairs. They all had their rejected, deceased and void tax returns laid in their laps. I sat down in an empty chair. Welcome to the R27s, said the old woman beside me. After a while, an HMRC employee popped his head out a door opposite the one I'd come through and called, James Pierce! A man leapt up and followed him into an adjoining room. It's limbo, you know, he hissed at me as he passed. It's not, dear, said the old woman. It's actually a waiting room in the HMRC. Don't pay any attention to him. But a young man next to her shook his head. She seemed to have a handle on the situation, so I thought I might as well ask. I'm dead, aren't I? I said. I couldn't possibly tell you. She directed her attention back to her large print Mills and Boone. They'll decide. Try not to worry about it. I'm dead, I said, in tones swimming with my own worry. I mean, that's the obvious twist, isn't it? I'm dead. We're all dead. We have to wait here forever. That would certainly be obvious, she said mildly. That, or an ironic flip, and everyone else is dead. All of HMRC. Don't be cruel, dear, they just seem that way. This isn't the others. The boy on her right leant around. It's the uncertainty that gets you in it. Why, we've been singled out. I've been here 2 years now. You've been here for 45 minutes, Damien, said a Scottish man on the opposite side of the waiting room. I looked at him. Do you know if we're dead? I asked. Legally, we're all dead, he said with the air of someone who had declared themselves an expert. In actuality, who knows? I suspect only a few of us are dead. How many? 1 in 10,
he said decidedly. 1 in 10. A good, solid ratio, he said. So, the question is, do you feel alive? I thought about it. I'm not sure anymore, I said honestly. Me either, said Damien. Pearl? Asked the Scottish man. She laid down her Milton Boone so that she could really consider it. I'm very sure I don't feel dead. I don't feel alive, mind you. Not alive, alive. I've not just done a bungee jump or robbed a bank. I don't feel alive, but I still feel extant, she smiled at us. Right, extant, I said. Me too. I don't feel dead. Do you feel undead? No. Shame, said the Scottish man, gesturing to James Pierce, who'd come back in and was pulling on his coat. Jim there felt undead. Cotard syndrome. Triggered, we think, by him being marked dead on the HMRC system. But now they know. Look, he can leave the R27s and go home. And the upside is that his wife will have power of attorney. He'll never have to fill in another tax return. An HMRC employee was signing the last of Jim's forms as he went. It had all been very quick. They ushered him out with a smile. I was just about to ask the room whether they all thought we were living in a big computer simulation when the same employee called my name. Damien gave me a subtle fingers crossed and Pearl rubbed my arm. Good luck not being dead, dear. The room beyond R27 had none of its otherworldliness. It was full of filing cabinets for a start. A man sat down at the desk, gestured for me to sit opposite, and tapped away at his computer wordlessly for a while. I felt like I was applying for a loan. Ah, I see, he said at last. 28th of August. This one's an easy one. Janet, go and get a head start on one of the others. A woman standing at the back of the room nodded and walked out briskly. I really should apologise, he said, looking up at me for the first time. You probably worked this out anyway. It's just a glitch in the system. Wrong column ticked or a double of your name somewhere. I'm not positive, but I'm very sorry you had to come all the way down here. How often does this happen? I said. There's a whole waiting room of people out there. Well, there are different reasons. Mostly mistakes in the numbers, though. You'd be surprised how often these things occur. The other way round as well. Lots of dead people are accidentally declared living every year. What waiting room do you keep them in? I said. His eyes glazed a little. Oh, God. You don't want to see what it's like in there. Kidding. He added and tucked my newly viable tax return into one of the filing cabinets. You're free to go. Sorry again. And have a great day and life. I was keen to share my news with the rest of the R27s and tell them to perk up and get a grip. A day of queuing and waiting had obviously made us hysterical, and the sooner we accepted we were all alive, the better. As I entered the white room, though, I saw two HMRC officials bent over Pearl. She was being sealed bodily in a huge polythene bag stamped deceased and void, from which she shrugged at us in a resigned, slightly disappointed way, before wobbling out of the room. There was a third door I hadn't noticed before. She disappeared through it in her bag, flanked on either side by HMRC officials. The Scottish man wouldn't meet my eye, but I could tell he was counting up the number of people doing mental arithmetic. At least she knows now, said Damien to me. Good luck, I said, and walked through the queuing atrium, up the stairs, and directly out into the Whitehall sunshine. Life went on, for some of us. K Kate, true to her word and thrilled that I was legally alive, took me for a drink at the Vale that night. I didn't tell her about the R27. Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2 was still on a loop in my head. And no matter how much I tried to focus on the taste of the Pinot Grigio and the music over the speakers, the image of Pearl and that third door was there too, projected onto my eyelids when I closed them like a camera flash. It's hard to repress fully. It's been surfacing almost daily for the last weeks, usually just before I fall asleep. Kate clinked her glass against mine. "Here's to life," she said.
Thank you, Susan. And that brings our evening to a spooky close. For those of you who are still extant, we'll be here for a while yet, so do stay for a chat. For those of you who are deceased, please make your way out onto Oxford Street with all the other zombies. Either way, kindly give it up for tonight's wonderfully alive actors and soon-to-be-destitute authors. Good night.